Welcome to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange, a weekly public affairs program helping you to ask questions, find answers, and distinguish the truth from the lie. I'm Kelly O'Romaris. Today we begin a four-part series on energy called The End of the Age of Oil. To understand why 9/11 happened, and to understand why in mid-October of 2002, the United States is on the brink of an imperial war of aggression against Iraq, one must understand that the world is facing an energy crisis, a crisis based not on market or political forces, but on physical reality. The world is running out of the cheap oil and natural gas that powered the Industrial Revolution and the beginning of the Information Age. Over the next 4 weeks, we will explore in depth the scientific data concerning the coming shortages, the implications of this energy crisis on geopolitics and economics, possible alternative energy sources and strategies, and the impact of the end of the age of oil on human culture. We begin with Michael C. Rupert, publisher and editor of the monthly newsletter From the Wilderness, an independent journalist with 25 years of experience researching covert operations. Rupert is the leading investigator into U.S. government foreknowledge of the September 11th attacks. For the past year, he has given a series of lectures titled The Truth and Lies of 9/11, which has drawn on government documents and media reports worldwide to debunk the notion that the United States government had no foreknowledge of the attacks and no idea that aircraft could be used as weapons. On October 4, 2002, Rupert gave his lecture at Lowell High School Auditorium in San Francisco, California. Speaking to an audience of about 500 people, Rupert explained the ties between 9/11, oil, and war. What follows are excerpts of that lecture.
What this is about giving you a map. I would submit to you that much of the difficulty and the animosity that exists, that has existed, not so much between me and the Bush administration, because we're both following the same map. I know what map they're following, but the animosity that has existed to some extent within the progressive community and my work is because we're following two different maps. The issue is about reality, fearless, psychologically and spiritually healthy demand and quest for nothing but the truth, no matter how scary it is. So we're going to start off tonight by giving you a better map. And this is where it's going to be important for all of us to know that as we pursue this, we must adhere to the map and not let people change our map in the name of being our friends to tell us we'll have an easier time if we let them change our map. The scariest part first, the worst part of the map, I have to tell you about first, because I have to plant this in your consciousness. The world is running out of oil. The world is running out of oil. The universe took hundreds of millions of years to make X amount of oil, which was discovered or started to be used in the 1880s, 1890s. We've used half of all the oil on the planet in 100 years. Half of all the oil that it took hundreds of millions of years to build. What you see on the screen behind me is called the Hubbert curve. Just to tell you that all oil production follows a bell curve. And that's true whether I have one particular oil field. Like in Texas, you see in the movies, you know, the old movies like Giant, you know, they drill one well and the oil's under great pressure and they've got one well and they get the big gusher. So they drill, you know, 25, 30 wells, it's not gushing anymore, but the oil's right there, it comes right out. As the oil depletes, as it goes down into the reservoir, it's more expensive, it takes more energy, and it's harder to produce. But eventually, as you're going up, drilling more and more wells, more and more wells, more and more wells, but the level's going down and down, you reach a peak of production. And then it tapers off until a field is dry, and a field is deemed to be dry when it takes more energy to produce a barrel of oil than you get by burning it or consuming it. Very straightforward. The planet works the same way. And the science developed by Dr. Hubbert, has proven to be incredibly accurate, but it seems that we're ahead of his schedule. But the red line here says hydrocarbon production. Now that's oil and natural gas. The hydrocarbon production curve is scheduled to peak, he said, slightly before the year 2020. We may have already passed that peak now. There's new evidence coming, and I'm going to soon have an article by Professor Colin Campbell, who is a world-renowned 40-year expert from the oil industry, PhD, who's been lecturing at universities talking about, look, the species of petroleum man is going to perish. The petroleum man subspecies of the human race is going to become extinct. The green line here, the green line is population over time, and this line, the black line, is actually hydrocarbon production per capita. Now, here it says we are going to reach the peak right around 2005, let's say, or a little before. But these are actual use numbers, and you see that they're all moved this way of the peak. So we have actually passed the peak of hydrocarbon production per capita, and I just confirmed before I flew up here yesterday that the world passed the peak of oil production per capita, not oil and gas, just oil, in 1979. There never will be any more oil produced per person than there was in 1979. We're running out. But notice the population curve keeps growing, and demand is increasing almost exponentially. The United States passed its peak of production. Venezuela's passed its peak of production. The North Sea has passed its peak of production. Alaska has long since passed its peak of production. South America has. As a matter of fact, there are very few regions that have not passed their peak of production, meaning that as they go down, it's more and more expensive to get less and less oil out of the ground. And bear in mind also that not all oil in the ground is recoverable. It gets trapped in crevices, all the different little caverns don't connect. Sometimes it's granulated and there's water blocking it. They'll put in steam, but you can't get it all out. Tar sands are extremely expensive. Now, when you think of oil, almost everyone's first reaction is SUVs. It's so much more than that. Oil is 95% of all the plastics on the planet. Think of everything in your house. Your dashboard is plastic. Your food is wrapped in plastic. Your computer is plastic. You probably have plastic chairs in the office where you work, plastic desks. Everything you buy at the store is wrapped in plastic. That's all petroleum. That's all oil. More than that, all pesticides are petroleum-based, all commercial pesticides. And all commercial fertilizers are derived from ammonia, which is made from natural gas, oil's twin sister. And it is oil and gas that allow 1 acre of land that would normally produce 30 bushels of corn to produce 135 bushels of corn. That's what's feeding the world today. But more than that, you eat oil. You eat oil because when the agribiz goes out there, they have these great machines that are powered by internal combustion engines with oil that go out and till the soil and plant the seeds. Then you have some cases, electrically operated devices that derive electricity from your electrical generating station that's probably powered by natural gas or oil that produce the electricity. And when they go out and fertilize it, they spray oil on it or natural gas on it. They spray it with pesticides, that's oil. When they harvest it, they drive another oil-powered machine out there to harvest it. Then they use an oil-powered machine to drive it to a processing plant which runs on oil. Then after they process it, they refrigerate it, which is derived from electricity produced by oil and natural gas. Then they drive it by oil to your supermarket, where you drive oil to get to the supermarket to get it, and it's wrapped in oil. We eat oil. There is no other energy that has been proven to be as efficient as oil. There are many other alternative technologies, but the major oil companies have brutally and ruthlessly suppressed them, and they are not immediate solutions. There are no panaceas. The young kids come up to me and say, we can go nuclear, we can go wind power, we can go hydrogen, we can do this. And I say, okay, what are you going to do? Are you going to throw 2.5 million auto workers out of work tomorrow in Detroit and tell them they can no longer make internal combustion engines? If you do, who's going to pay their mortgages? Who's going to buy their groceries at the supermarkets that hire people that depend upon the auto workers spending their paychecks? Who's going to change the electrical power generating stations all over this country that run on natural gas or petroleum overnight? How do you change that infrastructure? You can't. It's too late. There are many things we should and could be doing, but we are being blocked by a regime which understands one thing: as long as they control oil, they control the population of the planet. And they will control the population of the planet or kill it rather than relinquish control of the planet. This is more what it looks like. This is a great slide from a wonderful article that you can find referenced on my website called The Road to the Olduvai Gorge. Whoa, we got... Okay, 1930, Great Depression. This is oil consumption. Peak, World War II. Major peak in consumption. We just became energy pigs up until about the 1970s. That's the 70 oil crisis. Then we hit a slope and peak in production. And we are now on this slide. And this slide is leading to this cliff. And this cliff will result in blackouts. It will result in people burning candles. That's the science. It can be avoided. It can't be avoided. It can be ameliorated. It can be improved. It can be, there are many ways to deal with it, but not the way that it's being dealt with now. I said at Portland State, November 28th of last year, that what we are witnessing, as Dick Cheney said, in this war that will not end in our lifetimes, is a sequential war to control the last oil reserves on the planet, to make sure nobody else gets them. Because when the lights go out, there will be war, there will be violence, there will be bloodshed, there will be end of civilizations and nation states, and many people will die. And the people who run this country have decided that they will decide who will live and who will die. And that's what this is all about. Now, not all countries happen to peak at the same time. I mentioned that before. Now, 25% of all the oil in the world is in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. 11% of all the oil in the world is in Iraq. 9% of all the oil in the world is in Iran. You're going to see the significance of that. But the OPEC nations peak later. I told you that the rest of the world is already on a downslide. That's 2020. I apologize for the graphic. But OPEC peaks last. Remember that peaking last means it's cheaper to get your oil out of the ground. Look at the economy of the world around us. It's in great distress. Where do you find the cash to build monstrous pipelines? Where do you find the cash to go and build new refineries? You know, all the oil companies are downsizing. They know the world's running out of oil. They're downsizing and merging. That's why they're all merging. They know the world's running out of oil. But the OPEC nations peak last. And if uncontrolled, unoccupied, if they are, as Henry Kissinger said about 25 years ago, oil is too important to give to the Arabs. Okay. They peak last, which makes them the strongest, one of the key points of control on the planet. We will talk about Central Asia, which is key also to the military deployments and the events around September the 11th. Next slide. Now, a lot of people come running up to me and say, oh, come on, Mike, oil comes from magma. No, it doesn't. The space aliens are going to give us all the energy we can possibly use. No, that's not true. The Earth is a closed sphere. Logic tells us that. Go look at your refrigerator and see how much food grows in there. It doesn't happen. Then they come to me and they say, oh, they're finding new oil all the time. The estimates of reserves are being changed all the time. Well, if you read From the Wilderness, Dale Allen Pfeiffer, a wonderful writer, is our contributing editor for Energy. He's a geologist, and he knows a lot about oil. And he was doing research for one of his articles, and he was going through the U.S. Geological Survey reports, and he found this little footnote. We adjust our projection of reserves based upon anticipated demand. That is not science, okay? And it's the same thing with OPEC. Now, some people have noted that all the OPEC nations found all this new oil in the mid-80s. And that is not the truth. What the truth is that OPEC has a contract that they can only produce at a fixed percentage of barrels per day based upon their known reserves. So they all decided, because the U.S. drastically needed reduced oil prices after our market crash in 87 to recover, that, okay, we'll just rewrite our reserves. And that way we can produce more. That's exactly what Venezuela, Iran, Abu Dhabi, Kuwait, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia did. But look at Dubai. They didn't. And they have never changed their reserve projections, which have stayed constant. This is all bookkeeping. In other words, the books on oil are as cooked as the books on Enron. Absolutely. Now, probably the most important story, or one of the most important stories From the Wilderness has published, since 9/11, and this one I'm pretty proud of, has to do with the administration's relationship to oil and some of the secrets of 9/11 that you probably don't know about. There's a great journalist who has been kind of a pioneer. He's getting a little old now, but he's done some great work. Seymour Hersh in New York, who broke the My Lai massacre story. Now, he's having a hard time psychologically coming to grips with some of the truths of 9/11. But in July of 2001, he wrote an incredible story in the New Yorker magazine called The Price of Oil. And in that story, he described a series of events. And what happened was, when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, the major oil companies had their eyes on Central Asia for a long time. A bunch of states, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, all the stands, became independent. They immediately moved into Central Asia because they knew that there were very large oil and gas reserves, nowhere near Saudi Arabia. But the idea is, when you're running out of oil, you diversify as fast as you can so that you're not dependent upon one particular location. And you have to control the oil that's there. These were untapped reserves, now probably estimated to be, they're much smaller than everybody originally thought. They're still hugely significant, and there's lots of natural gas. So what happened was, Chevron, Texaco, bought into Kazakhstan heavily and secured about half the equity rights in the Tengiz oil fields and large oil fields in Kazakhstan, dealing with President Nursultan Nazarbayev. And our current national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, was the Kazakhstan expert for Chevron. That was her job before she became our national security advisor. You know that she has a tanker named after her. But ExxonMobil didn't quite get in, and they had to get in late. And what Cy Hirsch reported was that ExxonMobil bribed the president of Kazakhstan, Nursultan Nazarbayev, paid out about $1 billion in cash, and they committed to $20 billion plus of investment. Chevron had, TotalFina, Elf was there, and all the major oil companies had bought into this. But Exxon bribed Nazarbayev, about $500 million of that $1 billion, never made it to the Kazakh treasury. And he was getting tennis courts, private jets, you know, all this good stuff, which is kind of interesting. But it gets more interesting when in 1997, all the oil companies were crazed, because during this whole period of time, they're trying to get pipelines built. Here's Kazakhstan. Now, they're trying to build pipelines. Here's all the oil, the natural gas is here in Turkmenistan, and they're saying, well, we can build a pipeline through, nah, Russia, I mean, we gotta deal with the Russian mafia. Russia wants to regain imperial control of the region, they're a strategic threat. We can't build the pipelines there. Here's the major market, China and Japan and Indonesia. We can't build a pipeline that way. We can't build a pipeline that way because, oh my God, there's Iran. We have the Iran Trading Sanctions Act. We can't do business with Iran. This is very complicated. There is one pipeline now, and you'll see it later here. We can get it out of the Caspian over to the Black Sea and then sail it out. No, can't go that way. That's a 7,000-mile pipeline task. $12 billion, 5, 6, 7 years to build. Who knows? No, we can't do that. Because China, wait a minute, we can build a pipeline right there. And this was planned for a long time. An oil pipeline directly here, and a natural gas pipeline here. Now, why is it going that way? Well, because India is a huge consumer of natural gas. They have virtually no oil. And they have a large growing population, the second largest population on the planet, almost 1 billion people. And they need electricity for their economy. And there was a company called Enron that built a $3 billion plant in Dabhol, India, to service Bombay. But they needed natural gas to generate the electricity. Now, they had a deal with Qatar, which petered out, and so they couldn't get any natural gas, so they had this $3 billion investment that was going no place, and they needed this pipeline. So the deal throughout the middle and late 1990s was to get the Taliban to agree and to stabilize the country so that the pipelines could be built, and you'll see that. But everybody needed this oil, plus the major oil companies were going crazy. They had billions and billions and tens of billions of dollars in cash tied up, and they couldn't monetize their investment. They couldn't sell anything. So this became critical. So what we find from Cy Hirsch's story, I took this and I started looking. Now, do you remember when Enron broke the John Ashcroft Demented John Ashcroft? Okay. Group therapy works. John Ashcroft puts clothes on statues. John Ashcroft, when Enron scandal broke, John Ashcroft stood up and said, "Wait a minute, I'm a Christian man. I took campaign donations from Enron in my Senate race in 2000. I promptly and immediately recused myself from having anything to do with the Enron investigation. I might have a conflict of interest." Okay, guess what? Well, Cy Hirsch documented in his story that there were a number of grand juries that had been impaneled looking into the bribery of ExxonMobil of the Kazakh government, President Nazarbayev, and that Mobil had engaged in an illegal oil swap through Iran, a violation of the Iran Trading Sanctions Act of 1996. Three grand juries, one in New York, two in Washington, D.C., heavyweight offenses that could result in major oil companies being divested, heavily fined, serious charges. And the problem is that ExxonMobil gave John Ashcroft more money in 2000 than Enron did. And there's another target of those grand juries who I identified, BP Amoco, that's also connected to the bribery and the oil swap, who also gave John Ashcroft a lot of money. And he, not only did he not recuse himself from those grand juries, he took control of them, according to sources I developed in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington. That is a criminal conflict of interest. Now, there's one good reason why he took control of those grand juries. The bribery of the president of Kazakhstan, who signed the treaty allowing ExxonMobil to buy into the Central Asian oil, was approved by the Kazakh state government's oil advisory board. And the illegal oil swap through Iran for Mobil was approved by the Kazakh state government's oil advisory board. Do you know who was sitting on the Kazakh state government's oil advisory board when the deals were consummated? Dick Cheney, chairman of Halliburton. He is a legitimate known target of two sitting federal grand juries, and yet they've been interfered with. Many of the secrets of 9/11 lie in the Vice President's Energy Task Force, which has been hiding its records from us, breaking the law, and it was about to be a constitutional crisis before the attacks of 9/11, and the GAO has just filed suit again. They just went to court, I think this last week, on the Energy Task Force records, and the government's not given them. Who met? Who was there? We also know that BP Amoco and ExxonMobil got into the Vice President's Energy Task Force. We've confirmed that. That's the legal equivalent of having Manuel Noriega consulting in the war on drugs. I'm serious. It is. Now, just a little history of the pipelines, and this is so well documented now, but we have lots of congressional records, and I'll have some more in my book, I mean, but the oil companies were frantic, not just Unocal, but others. Unocal had been the prime contractor for a gas pipeline out of the region, and there's a lot of people saying Unocal's not back in the game post 9/11, but indeed they are. We have a story on our website, Pipelineistan, showing that Unocal's very much in play. But the pipelines are still being built. Unocal isn't the only pipeline construction company. This is testimony from John J. Maresca, the Vice President of International Relations of Unocal, testifying before the House International Relations Committee. And it says, the only other possible route option is across Afghanistan, which has its own challenges. We have made it clear that construction of our proposed pipeline cannot begin until a recognized government is in place that has the confidence of government, lenders, and our company. Cannot begin construction until, there is an abundant record that the Taliban was the problem, but the U.S. government, even until weeks before 9/11, was conducting last-ditch negotiations with the Taliban to try to get them to surrender Osama bin Laden and agree to the pipelines. They would not do it. As a matter of fact, the Taliban had delivered major blows to the U.S. long before 9/11, but they knew what kind of war they were waging. They were waging an economic war. Who's that? Now it comes to the fun part. I didn't bring the book, but how many people have seen the book, The Grand Chessboard? You read it? Great. Zbigniew wrote a book. You know who he is, right? Jimmy Carter's National Security Advisor, co-founder of the Trilateral Commission with David Rockefeller, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, professor at Johns Hopkins University. He's also What else does he do? He does everything bad. But you know, he's one of the. I saw him on a show in New York last May. Mike and I were in New York, and I turned on the TV, and there he was on the podium at the State of the World Economic Forum, and here's Hillary Clinton, Zbigniew Brzezinski, George Soros, Shimon Peres, a guy from Yale, and a guy from Harvard. And I thought, there you go. There you go. How many people think George Soros is a really good guy? Sometimes, that's a great answer. He's a man who destroys currencies and makes billions of dollars. He is also very philanthropic, but he also can control debate by being philanthropic and shutting off the channels of funding if people don't espouse the way he chooses. Zbigniew writes this book, 1997, The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives. 5 years ago, he put a map into his book telling us where the next world conflict was going to be. Does that look familiar?
Yeah.
Start Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Iran, and this was the area where the conflict would spread. That's a five-year-old map. Now, when I was with LAPD, we would call that a clue. That's a clue. Okay? That's highly suspicious to me. But look down here, he says, moreover, as America becomes an increasingly multicultural society, it may find it more difficult to fashion a consensus on foreign policy issues, except in the circumstance of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat. Do you think that Caesar would have balked at the idea of sacrificing 3,000 Roman lives for the sake of the empire? Do you think Adolf Hitler would have balked? Do you think Napoleon would have balked? Do you think any empire in human history would have even hesitated? You can rule the world for the cost of 3,000 of your own? Why do you think we're different? Come out of denial. It's not a river in Egypt. Next slide. Now, what is interesting about this is that this is a plan that's been implemented and thought of for a long, long time. It doesn't just happen with one administration. There are forces and powers and string pullers well above both political parties. They are, if you will, the board of directors that run the country. And at any given point in time, whoever occupies the White House is no more than an executive vice president who can be removed at will if he doesn't follow the agenda.
You are listening to Rise, Radio Internet Story Exchange. This is part one of a four-part series called The End of the Age of Oil. I'm Kelly O'Ramaris. Today's program features Michael C. Rupert, publisher and editor of From the Wilderness, speaking about 9/11, oil, and war. The centerpiece of Rupert's lectures on the truth and lies of 9/11 is the so-called Lucy timeline, named after Ricky Ricardo's signature comment on the old I Love Lucy TV show. Oh, Lucy, you got a lot of splainin' to do. The list of things that need splainin' has grown from 26 items to over 100. According to Rupert, the seeds of the 9/11 attacks were sown as early as 1991, when major oil companies began investing in Central Asia. The timeline continues to grow as events unfold that validate the assertion Rupert made shortly after the 9/11 attacks. The attacks were the trigger for a war for oil planned long before September 11, 2001. The Lucy timeline is now a list so long that Rupert can no longer deliver it in its entirety in his lectures. The complete timeline is available on his website, www.fromthewildernessoneword.com or www.copvcia.com. Here are excerpts of the timeline that Rupert delivered on October 4, 2002, that bear on the subject of 9/11, oil, and war.
First of all, to summarize very briefly, in the 90s, the major oil companies poured billions of dollars in liquid cash, and they poured billions and billions of dollars, committed to hundreds of billions of cash investments. Again, that's cash. And in this economy especially, cash is king. Those of you who have credit cards will know that when you get your statement every month, you have a total balance owing, and then you have a minimum monthly payment due. How many people pay off your whole credit card balance every month? I wish I could do that. But you understand the difference. You can't pay your credit card bill with a bushel of wheat, nor with 40 hours of work, nor can you pay your mortgage or your rent. You have to have cash, and it works the same way for business. And the oil companies poured billions of dollars into Central Asia. They couldn't get the oil out. We also know that as early as 1995, the Philippine police had seized computers in the Philippines from Ramzi Youssef that called for the hijacking of 10 aircraft and crashing them into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, a number of installations. We know now that the government knew categorically that aircraft could be used as weapons. We've seen all those revelations over the last couple of weeks, thanks to the work that we all have done. We come down to point four. Did you know that, by the way, Unocal was so desperate to get the pipeline that in 1997 they invited representatives of the Taliban to their Texas headquarters for a barbecue? Come on down, let's have a barbecue. Yes, sir, bring on down. We'll use our sheep, not yours, you know, and our cows, and not yours. But they still couldn't work out a deal on the pipeline because the Taliban knew what they were doing. Now, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and Bin Laden were all creations of the CIA. And those relationships remained highly intact up to 2001, September the 9th, especially through the financing of Khalid bin Mahfouz and Saudi financiers and major banking institutions, but also especially through the Pakistani ISI intelligence service that was pulling a great many strings. We come down to, down here, it's very important to note that Enron had this $3 billion investment in the power plant at Dabhol, India, and that's going to become very critical. By 1999, the government had changed positions, and the strategic goal had been no longer to negotiate with the Taliban on the one hand without a stick, and they started using the stick in 1999. First we had the embassy bombings, then we launched cruise missiles, but Clinton signed an executive order banning all business with the Taliban, but the negotiations where the pipeline still continued in the back door. This was from, obviously, from the White House website with their list of executive orders. This is very interesting. In the summer of 2001, the Washington Post and New York Daily News, obtained government emails showing, and it was reported in the Albion Monitor, that the National Security Council, now if you're familiar with the structure of government, the NSC is the White House. That's the White House body that oversees all of the military and all of the intelligence services. They convened a Dabhol working group for the benefit of Enron. Enron. This is not an economic policy relief issue about Enron not being able to get natural gas. This is the National Security Council trying to figure out how to bail Enron out of this $3 billion investment in India because they can't get natural gas. That is also what we call a clue. Members of the G8 meeting. The G8 meeting in Genoa, Italy was one of the most pivotal events before the attacks of 9/11 that occurred in July. They discussed the Taliban at the G8 meeting, the eight largest industrialized nations in the world. They discussed the handing over of bin Laden, and according to Pakistani representative Ambassador Naiz Naik, the U.S. delegation led by former Clinton Ambassador Tom Simmons warned of a military option if the Taliban did not change position. This is from another good book about 9/11 called Bin Laden, The Forbidden Truth by Jean-Charles Brisseau and Guillaume Destier that has unfortunately been published in the States by The Nation Books, and some of the harder text has been changed in the translation. By the Nation Books, as opposed to what was in the French version. But immediately after the G8 summit, three American officials, Tom Simmons, Carl Underfirth, and Lee Coldren, have a meeting called the 6+2 meeting that's extremely well documented now with Pakistani, Russian intelligence, other intelligence agencies in Berlin. The Taliban is there, they come in and out of some of the meetings. But the ISI is the basic telephone line to the Al-Qaeda, and they say, look, guys, we're going to planning military strikes. You either give us bin Laden, organize the country so we can build the pipelines and we'll bury you under a carpet of gold. Otherwise, we're going to bury you under a carpet of bombs in October. So well known was this plan, actually, that Indian papers and other papers in the region, and we have them in the timeline, were saying that military action against the Taliban was coming in October, and that was long before the attacks of September the 11th. Late August, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, who was the head of the Saudi intelligence service, was fired. And he was, for 25 years, one of bin Laden's best friends. The Saudi Arabian connections to the attacks of 9/11 are legendary, extremely well documented, and very significant. What is amazing, though, is that for almost a year after 9/11, we heard nothing about the Saudi connections, and then they became an issue about 2 months ago. And I'm going to tell you why in just a few minutes. But he was fired because he was too close to bin Laden, and the attacks were coming. Now, just before September the 11th, isn't it strange that on September the 10th, in an exercise known as Operation Swift Sword, the British had 23,000 combat troops on their way to Oman, which is right next, it's 100 miles from Pakistan across the Gulf there. They had the largest armada since the Falkland Islands War, gearing up out of London to leave to sail to Oman. The U.S. conveniently had two aircraft carrier battle groups in an abnormal rotation parked right off the Pakistani coast. And we also had 17,000 U.S. troops along with 23,000 NATO troops in Egypt for Operation Bright Star. Other information revealed that I started with and Nafis built on and Paul Thompson has built on shows that we've been training special troops in all the northern, all the countries that border Afghanistan to the north, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and we had troops deployed there all before September the 11th. Isn't that a clue? Yes, that's a clue. We've been planning, actually, for more than 4 years. Operation Swift Sword was 4 years in the planning, according to the British government's information that I saved. The Pakistani newspaper, The Frontier Post, says, golly gee, Ambassador Wendy Chamberlain, in light of recent geopolitical developments, just had a meeting with the Pakistani oil and gas minister. And all these pipelines that nobody could get built for all this time, guess what? They're all back on track in view of these new changes in world, these new geopolitical changes. The pipelines are, the World Bank just opened an office in Afghanistan, for God's sake, to finance the pipelines. Treaties have been signed, contracts have been signed. We have a story on our website called Pipelinistan that's very well researched. You want to see what the progress of the pipelines is. It's just amazing. How many people have seen Casablanca, the movie? One of my favorite lines. I'm shocked. There's gambling going on in this establishment. Afghanistan is once again, we're having no opium. A year ago, the world's largest producer of the opium poppy, and exactly as I predicted, just weeks after the attacks, that one of the first things that we would see as a result of this war would be a worldwide epidemic of heroin, which is now sweeping across Russia and Western Europe. And guess where the money's going to come? It's going to be controlled by the same guys that have arranged this war, Britain and the United States and the major banks and the oil companies. And there's a tie-in between the drug money and the oil companies. You got to build all these pipelines. Where do you get the cash? You got to sustain the economies and boost your stock prices. Where do you get the cash? One of the quickest ways to end this, and I'll never make anybody else see it or take action on it. If you want to end this madness, decriminalize drugs. I'm serious. It makes sense to you here and to me, but you'll never go out and argue that to the American people. They just won't get it. They just won't get it. Hamid Karzai is a former UNICAL employee. Are we surprised? The U.S. proconsul in Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, is a former UNICAL consultant who consulted on the pipelines. He is the puppet master who just made sure that Prime Minister Karzai kept his job when democracy threatened to raise its ugly head. Now, to talk about how insane the planet is, I heard a thing on CNN 2 days ago. The Nobel Committee is considering Hamid Karzai, George W. Bush, and Tony Blair for the Nobel Peace Prize. Beam me up, Scotty, there's no intelligent life here.
Several days after Rupert gave this lecture, the Norwegian Nobel Committee awarded the Peace Prize to former President Jimmy Carter. In what many view as a message to the White House, the committee said in its award citation, quote, "In a situation currently marked by threats of the use of power, Carter has stood by the principles that conflicts must be, as far as possible, resolved through mediation and international cooperation based on international law, respect for human rights, and economic development," unquote. You are listening to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange. We now return you to Michael C. Rupert on 9/11, oil, and war.
This is another one of those things that I call a clue. Now, this was a map that was devised by Harvard University, one of the great criminal empires in the country, James Intelligence Review, actually the Harvard Endowment. You know, under the Clinton administration, the Harvard Endowment went from $3 billion to $19 billion in just 8 years. It's run like a business, all because of the great government contracts, the looting of Russia. And Pug Whitaker of Harvard University, a very bigwig at Harvard University, founded a company called DynCorp, which processes the books for HUD and Department of Defense and handles all the defense switchboards and is flying helicopters in Colombia. And the same Pug Whitaker is chairman of the Enron Finance Committee, who approved all of Enron's financial reports. That's Harvard. Harvard, James University, U.S. Energy Information Administration, UNICAL, that's a clue, and Global Security. Now, we've added to this map. Mike did the graphics on this, but this is their map. They had all these troops. Okay, we got about 9,000 troops in Afghanistan. We've deployed in Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan. We've been training special troops in Turkmenistan, and I should get something up there. We have 100 to 200 acknowledged special forces in Georgia, where a pipeline is just going through, but I've got unconfirmed of another 1,000 or so special forces troops. 25,000 troops in Turkey. Of course, that's a NATO member. We have 7,000 troops in Jordan. Did you know that? It's confirmed. Yeah, it upsets me too. 3 or 4 stores in the Middle East, and then I spoke with a very eloquent aid worker who was with a UN-sponsored aid program from Jordan. She's an American from Huntington Beach, and she called me up and said, "I saw your story, you're right. I've been to Jordan, I was just there. I saw the armored personnel carriers with medical paintings, I saw armored vehicles, and I saw special forces." Now, they're there. So we got troops in Jordan, we got troops in Israel, we got troops, lots of troops in Egypt, lots of troops in Kuwait. Of course, we've got the air bases in Saudi Arabia. You know why George Bush didn't wipe out Saddam Hussein the first time? So he could leave the U.S. military bases in Saudi Arabia. We Oman, British troops, and Qatar is sinking under the weight of deployed troops now. We counted 105,000 troops that are already so far forward deployed, they have to be used in an invasion. Scott Ritter, another name that deserves our applause. Gotta honor courage wherever you find it, and boy, he's got some, I'll tell you that. He said it very clearly, the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force, they're so far